I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. A charming new book is out now from Lorna Crozier, the distinguished award-winning poet and writer, has written The Book of Marvels, a Compendium of Everyday Things. These prose pieces look at items that we'd find in a household, zippers, erasers, lamps, collars, as well as things we'd find on the people we'd find in a household, navels, brains, hearts, vaginas. There are 85 vignettes in this book. It's a delightful and thoughtful book. Lorna Crozier was last on in 2009 when her memoir Small Beneath the Sky was published. She's also written 15 books of poetry and edited several anthologies. Her website is at lornacrozier.ca. Incidentally, Lorna Crozier will be making a number of appearances at next month's Vancouver International Writers Festival, Friday morning the 19th at 10 on a panel, and Sunday the 21st of October at the afternoon tea at 3. She'll also be part of the tribute to her husband, Patrick Lane, that Saturday night, the 20th of October at 8 p.m. This book is published by Greystone. On the mouth, she writes, there are most obnoxious parts on our body, unfamiliar with manners, with common sense, or cool reflection. We'll use ours now for this interview. I'm very pleased to welcome back to the Plant on the Line program from Saanich, British Columbia, Lorna Crozier. Ms. Crozier, good morning.
Hi, Joe. Nice to be here.
Thanks for joining us. So this book, this isn't poetry, it's prose, but it reads like poetry.
Yeah, I'm really interested in the form that I heard you call them prose poems, and it's this kind of big umbrella word that includes so many things. I see these as prose poems, but they tilt towards the side, I think, of the short essay or meditation or contemplation. And I think the poetic part of them lies in the way that language is used. I was very conscious when I wrote these of the sound and cadence of the sentences rather than the poetic lines this time. So as when I write a poem, I read every line out loud to make sure that the sound is right. This time I read every sentence out loud to try to create, you know, vocal patterns and smooth syntax and all that kind of thing.
Yeah, and so do you approach writing a book like this differently than, say, you would your poetry?
That's a really good question. In some ways, I suppose so, and in other ways, not. I think the book, if my memory is correct, started about 3 years ago with a poem about the coffee pot. I think that was the originating object, and I was actually staying in a residence with a group of 8 other writers, and I was getting really pissed off at the person who wasn't making the coffee, who would pour the last cup and leave, mm-hmm. you know, that burning thick inch in the bottom for the next person to make the next cup. Yeah. And so that inspired it, and I wrote it in a way as a message to this invisible person, and I tacked it on the cupboard wall in the kitchen. And then once I did that, I thought, gee, you know, this is really fun, thinking about objects and writing about them. Why don't I see if I can push it a little further? So unlike with poems where I face the blank page every time I go to write a new poem, this time I had an idea of a series or a sequence, and I had the form. And most importantly, I think the tone. I think that's what's hard to get when you're working on a longer piece or a group of pieces, is you have to make sure that you've stumbled upon the right tone. And once you get that, you can go on a bit of a roll, like a novelist does. I've never written a novel, but it was fun to know when I woke up in the morning that I had a writing task ahead of me, and I knew at least halfway what it was going to be, what form it was going to be in, and what a possible topic might be.
So these 85 pieces are organized in the book alphabetically. In terms of writing them, did you write them in order?
No, I didn't. I had written, maybe about 50 or 60 of them, and then tried to figure out now how should I arrange these, and, you know, the alphabet is one of the oldest forms of arrangement. And it's that lovely kind of random way, really, of putting things together. And I thought, okay, well, I've almost got an alphabet, so why don't I start filling in what I don't have? And, of course, letters that I didn't have were things like X, Y, and Z. Yeah. And I didn't have an A at the time, you know, odd things like that. I didn't have a V. I had several C's, but I didn't limit myself to just one object per letter. I just let that roll. But I started to fill in the alphabet, and that was challenging as well. but kept me going for another year or so, making sure I had all 26 letters.
So you have 85 in the book. Did you write more than 85, say?
I wrote about 90, and my editor and I took 5 out. And it was mainly because they were more abstract. One was called Glib, G-L-I-B, and it was about glibness in talking. And it didn't, although I referred to a couple of objects, it didn't have the object-centeredness that the rest had. And so we thought it didn't work. And then we debated whether we should leave in something like happiness, but I argued for it because I grounded happiness, first of all, in a dog, and then in a movie, and, you know, so on and so on. So we thought that it didn't look out of place. But the ones that got left out were more about abstractions than the material world.
One sentence that I've been thinking of for days after reading it, on the eraser, you write, "The eraser on the top of the pencil saves the writer from ridicule and shame." I mean, it's awfully thoughtful and true, isn't it?
Yeah, I worried a little bit that I'm being slightly old-fashioned because I don't know of anyone right now who writes with a pencil and
exactly.
eraser, unless you're stuck on the beach or something and you're trying to write a poem. But I knew that everyone would at least understand the metaphor. And so the eraser certainly, I hope, saves the writer from ridicule and shame, and hopefully a good editor does too.
Yeah, did you, I mean, I was trying to think now when the last time was that I bought an eraser.
I still have one, actually, and it might be because I grade student essays, and I put my final remarks in pencil and their final grade in pencil so that I can have a couple of days to think about whether I've been fair, et cetera, and then I can go back and erase and rewrite. But mostly I cross things out if I'm writing in a notebook.
Yeah, it made me think about some of these things in the book that we may not have, I don't know, years from now, like the eraser, like glass doorknobs, say. Certain colors, certain shoes. In writing this book and looking at it as a whole, did you set out to write something that perhaps made us, the reader or yourself, look at life differently?
Yeah, I think so. One of my bugbears has been the tendency of humanity to think that we are the center of the universe. You know, that Genesis tells us that we have control over every living, creeping, flying thing, and that we are more important than the everyday materials around us. And so I think that part of this book, part of my impetus to write it, was to say, hey, you know, let's look outside of ourselves and look at what is a big part of our lives, whether that be spoons in the drawer or glass doorknobs from another time, you know, or a bowl that we eat from every morning. Why don't we take a look at these things and see what their essence is, what their significance is in this multiplicity of the world that we dwell in. So I think that's one of the things I was trying to do. Another thing I think that I hope happens in the book is that there's sort of a mythic feeling to the stories or the meditations. The myth comes out more obviously in the piece called Darkness, I think, where it really sounds like a myth, or maybe the piece on Rake. But even the bowl, I call it a thing that metamorphoses into something else. So there's a sort of a secret mystery to things like that, or mops that I wanted to tap and bring into language. However successfully or unsuccessfully I did that, that was part of my intent.
In terms of the research that one does for a book like this, I mean, you mentioned that you'd be sitting around and looking at these things around your house or elsewhere. But you do some research, don't you? Like, my parents are Filipino, so I never knew that the word yo-yo came from Tagalog. Did you look that up, or how?
Yeah, I did. Yeah. I did. I knew I wanted to write about the yo-yo. You know, I needed a why, yeah. And that was one of the first things that popped into my head. And I had a yo-yo when I was a kid, mm-hmm. So I knew what a yo-yo was and how to use it and so on and how significant it was to my childhood. But I didn't know its history, so, you know, I Googled yo-yo, and there was that wonderful bit, yeah, about its use in the Philippines as a hunting tool. So that's the kind of research I did. I also pulled on all the things I've stored in my brain over the years. You know, I think our brains are like magpies. Mm-hmm. They go out and they snatch something colorful and bright and they plop it in the nest and almost forget it's there. But I had a lot of fun just dipping back and saying, oh, yeah, I remember Napoleon had that stupid hat, and adding those kinds of things to the pieces, kind of in jokes,
yeah,
that in some ways were learned or were from popular culture but were never bookish or pedantic. I like pulling all of those things. I guess the word is synthesizing, being able to talk about many, many other things by looking at one simple thing.
It's a fun book to read. It seems like you had fun writing it.
I had a ball. I'm really, really sorry that it's over.
Yeah.
And I want to keep going, maybe a book too, but that might be too much. I don't know. But it's the most fun I've had writing in a long time.
Yeah. Now, how do you think we should read the book? Should we read it from A to Z or Z?
I don't know. I think if this book came across my desk and I hadn't written it, I would dip in and out of it.
Yeah.
It's probably a good bathroom book. or a book reading just before, yeah, you go to bed and you want to read for 10 minutes, you know, you can just flip through the pages and say, oh, here's one about crowbars, or here's one about the word but.
Yeah.
And that was the other fun thing I had, was I wanted to use a couple of words to treat them as if they were material things rather than just, you know, letters and sounds that we make in our mouths.
Yeah, I probably read, I guess, the first third from the beginning. Yeah. And then I had to go, I wanted to read the piece on linoleum for some reason. So I skipped. And then I guess I read the rest of the book, going to like Jell-O,
right,
going to feet, and then going to water and warts, and then back again.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose that's how most people will read this book, don't you think?
I hope so.
Yeah.
And you know, when I get a book of poetry, I read it that way. I often sort of start with the last poem, mm-hmm, and then I flip it through a few pages towards the front and read a couple of poems there, and I bounce around in poetry books, and then I read them from start to finish at a certain point just to sort of get the tone and the shape of the book. But I don't read a poetry book from page 1 to page 80, for instance, in consecutive sequence.
I read somewhere online, perhaps in an interview you gave elsewhere, that you're hearing from a lot of people online. I guess they email you, I suppose. I guess that's through your website, right?
I guess so.
Do you enjoy that feedback from your readers?
Oh, I really, really do. I just got one this morning, in fact, by a woman who was reading my latest poetry book, Small Mechanics, and she was telling me how it gave her some ways to look at her own writing and decide to tell her own story, no matter how painful it was. So, I mean, that kind of thing is just great, because we don't get a lot of touch, you know, a lot of contact from our readers, except when we're at literary festivals and they come to our readings. But this way, I love to hear that there's someone out there listening. Sometimes, especially if you're writing in the world of poetry, you think maybe no one is buying the books. And this assures you that you are indeed writing to some kind of audience.
Yeah, and do you get fans that write just wanting to say hi and things like that?
Yeah, I do, yeah. Joe, and that is very, very pleasing.
Yeah. In terms of the state of poetry in this country today, I mean, how are we doing? I mean, you teach at UVic. Are you seeing good writers come out?
Oh, just fantastic writers. I mean, Patrick Lane and I did those two anthologies of young writers under 30. I think the last one was around 2008 or so.
Mm-hmm.
I'm bad with dates, so I might be wrong on that, but it was maybe 5 or so years ago. And we did those anthologies because we had been meeting these superior young poets across the country, workshops we gave across Canada, or we'd meet them at literary festivals or whatever, and we thought, you know, these people need a podium. We have to get the word out that they exist. And I'm still seeing the same kind of thing of marvelous young poets writing amazingly good books. I think the state of poetry is really, really healthy. I don't think the state of poetry criticism is.
Do you think poetry is being taught well in schools? Like, I mean, like I graduated high school about 12 years ago. And
yeah.
People my generation, I mean, the only poetry that I think kids my age at the time, you know, would listen to would be in rap. And speaking for myself, I didn't think that I don't know if I liked, I guess I didn't like it because I didn't understand it, how to do it or how to read it or listen to it properly. Do you think that's changed?
I hope so. Sometimes I get, you know, notes from students. Well, I shouldn't say sometimes, almost daily.
Yeah.
I get a note from high school students or college students who have decided to present one of my poems to their class. You know, obviously they've been given an assignment and,
mm-hmm.
and they've found my poetry somewhere and chose me. And what still frustrates me about the notes I get from them, and I wonder what kind of teaching produces this kind of question, is that they ask me, could you please tell me what this poem means?
Mm-hmm.
And I wrote a response back to a student yesterday and said it's not the poet's task to tell you what the poem means. You know, the poem sits between you and me, and it should be saying something to you. And if it isn't, find another poem. And then the response I got back from her was, would you please highlight some of the lines and explain what your intention was?
Mm.
So I found that very, very frustrating, and I don't have time to go on and on with her and teach her how to read poetry, but I worry about how poetry is being taught, you know, what would lead her to ask that kind of question and persist in her asking, even when I gave her a small rap on the knuckles.
Do you see this book, the Book of Marvels, as a way to, I guess as an entryway, say, to poetry and your poems, maybe?
It would be great, Joe. I didn't write it with that intention,
mm-hmm.
but people seem to be more comfortable if they open a book and they see a paragraph instead of lines.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure why that is. I think it goes back to your question about the way poetry is taught, and that often the professor or the teacher is an interlocutor between the student and the poem, as if only the professor knows what the poem means, and the student has this struggle trying to figure out what it means. And no poet, you know, tries to hide the meaning. We all think we're being very clear in our intent. But there's this old-fashioned view that poetry has a message and that it's written in invisible ink and that prose doesn't. The prose is straighter. It's more of a straight talker. It comes right out and says what it means. So maybe because of that, because they're paragraphs, the book will look less intimidating and more accessible. I'm not sure.
We talked about replying to readers who write you. Do you ever have the desire to, say, rap the reviewer on the knuckle, say, if they've reviewed a book, perhaps not negatively, but may have criticized something that, I don't know, that you didn't agree with?
You know what, I'm trying really hard not to read my reviews.
Really?
Yeah. I remember hearing Richard Ford interviewed on the radio, with his last novel, so that would have been maybe 3 or so years ago, and he said that when he was a young man, he read his reviews, and they broke his heart,
mm-hmm.
and he decided he didn't want to have his heart broken anymore, so he didn't read his reviews. I guess fortunately or unfortunately, your friends always tell you that
yeah.
a review is out, and I've had several really good ones, especially the one in the Globe and Mail.
Yeah.
And the Vancouver Sun, and so I couldn't help but read them. But I'm trying to push myself away from it, because if you read them and they're positive, I don't know what good that does you, except you get a little fillip of pleasure, you know. And
mm-hmm.
But then you say, well, what if it had been negative? Would I then think the book isn't as good as if the review is positive? So it doesn't change the writer's view of the book. It just does something to your spirits, which isn't good for it, I think.
The reviews that I've read have been quite good. One criticism, and I hate to bring it up, but I'll bring it up anyway, has to do with, it's not really a criticism. It's just that they wish that you would write about other things, and so this builds into, will there be a second book?
Oh, well, that's good. Was that from the National Post?
Yeah.
Yeah, because somebody told me that there was a negative comment in it, so I didn't read it.
I guess what was negative about it was that why did you write about the vagina but not the penis?
Oh, yeah. I mean, why didn't I write about the tongue, too? You know what I mean? There's so many body parts. Like, I didn't write about every body part, and I didn't write about every object. And if that person had known my work, they would have known I wrote a whole sequence of poetry about the penis called the Penis Poems, which came out in a collection called Angels of Flesh, Angels of Silence. So I had kind of... I'm done with it. You know what I mean? I found various ways in language to comment on the penis, and I didn't feel that I could do anything new with that body part. So that's why I didn't write about it. But other objects, I'd love to go into them if I feel inspired, and possibly produce book two. But I don't want to repeat myself.
Yeah. Now, some of these pieces have appeared elsewhere. So I mean, you're not through with writing about everyday things, I suppose, right?
No.
What's your day like? Is it full-time for you at UVic?
Well, no, this time I'm teaching, what am I teaching? Two-thirds. I'm teaching two classes instead of three. And I know that doesn't sound like a lot to people who aren't university teachers, but of course that includes the, you know, the marking and the preparing of the classes and so on. So my week is really full with teaching. And then I try to do whatever writing I can over the weekend or during the summer.
Yeah. And
but this is my last semester, and then I'm out. So every day is a little bittersweet for me.
And so when you write, I think I've asked you this before. Patrick, I guess, is the first pair of eyes that sees what you've written. Is that right?
Yes, indeed.
And I guess the same for you, for him, I suppose.
Yeah, and it's great to have a very good editor in the room next door to yours.
Yeah, and so it is next door. You're not in the same room, right?
No, we both have. We're in a four bedroom house, and so two of the bedrooms we've turned into our offices.
Yeah,
and they're side by side. If we had a two story house, we'd have one office on one floor and one on the other. But there isn't any choice in terms of our layout.
And you write on a computer, do you?
Yes, I do. Yeah. Sometimes I write. My first drafts in a notebook or on a scrap of paper, and then I go to the computer shortly after. But I like the kind of cold objectivity a computer gives to your work, just like a typewriter used to. You know, when the words come out in that kind of print, I think you can see more clearly where you've slipped, where you've used a cliche, or where you've been sentimental, or where you have to push yourself a little harder. Whereas when you look at your own handwriting, it's still so much part of your body that you don't see quite as clearly.
And see, I'm not a writer, and I just find talk like that fascinating about craft. Yeah, it's just, and I'm sure other people find that interesting as well. The last book, Small Beneath the Sky, which you were on to talk about 3 years ago now, did that surprise you how well that book did?
Yeah, it's always a surprise and a delight when you find out that the book is selling, and you hear that people are enjoying it. I mean, you always worry when you write that maybe what I'm writing about is only of interest to me. So, you know, you're not solipsistic enough to think that everything that interests me interests 5,000 other people. So it's always a thrill when you find out, oh, this did interest 5,000 other people. But it's kind of an act of faith when you write that if you're doing something that matters to you and that is true in some profound way, that other people will find it so as well.
I'm sure a lot of people will find that this book will matter to them because it's everything that they're familiar with.
Yeah, I'm hoping so, and that's been the reaction I've been getting so far is, oh, wow, I'll never look at a doorknob the same way again.
Exactly.
You know?
Yeah.
And what was really important to me, Joe, in writing this was I think there are meditations on when reality butts its head against imagination. That those are the two things that are going on there, like two rams charging each other, and there's a bang. And I hope that the bang is producing some kind of energy, because these are things we all know really, really well, and I want it to be true to their essence, what they are like in their material shapes and what they're made of. And at the same time, I wanted imagination to take me more deeply into them than one would normally go.
This is a marvelous book, Lorna. It's been great talking again.
Really fun talking to you, Joe. Thanks for calling me.
You're very welcome. Good luck with the book. And say hi to Patrick.
I will, for sure.
The website for more, LornaCrozier.ca. The book is called The Book of Marvels, A Compendium of Everyday Things. It's published by Greystone. Its author, Lorna Crozier, on the line from Saanich in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plunter.